The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Now to a completely different walk of life and a story that has been cropping up over the years, the controversial question of ownership of 39 paintings in the Hugh Lane collection. W.B. Yeats, Lady Gregory, Michael Collins and Jack Lynch are among the many who have fought to bring the paintings back to Ireland in a dispute that has been going on for a century. We're joined by a woman who has been at the helm of the Hugh Lane Gallery for a quarter of that century. Barbara Dawson joins us now. Barbara, you grew up in rural County Carlow, a long way from the rarefied art scene of the capital. Tell me a little about your childhood.
Yes, I grew up in County Carlow, about 2 miles from Tullow in the countryside. And yeah, it was very, very nice growing up. I was one of six children, and we lived on a farm. My father was an auctioneer as well. He unfortunately died when we were all quite young. I was only seven, and my younger brother, the youngest of the family, Billy, was only 2.5.
So that was obviously very tough on your mother as well as yourselves. How did she respond in terms of the farm and the auctioneering, and what did she do?
Well, in looking back on it, she was a mighty woman, as they would say nowadays. She was 41 when she was widowed. She was a lot younger than my father. And, you know, he was one of those sort of post the recession of the 1930s that got up and started to develop business. And, you know, it's kind of the new generation of, if you like, business people. And so it was quite a challenge for her. He also, with two of his others, set up a cooperative livestock sales in Tullow. So these are very kind of male-oriented businesses, which she had to manage. And she did it very successfully. She had very good friends, both male and female, wonderful friends, and had a particularly wonderful advisor in a man called Stan Brophy. And so she knew how to take advice, which was interesting. And in a, what would you say, a male world, I think she managed quite well.
And for you then, were you interested in the farm? Did you enjoy that part
of life?
I did,
yes. We had bicycles. It still was the 60s, so we had bicycles riding around, and we had ponies, you know, and a donkey. So that was kind of idyllic for me. My brothers and sisters went away to school, but I was at home, and I quite liked it. I was at school with the Brigittine nuns in Tullow, who were very nice, and I had a particularly wonderful mentor called Sister Michael, who encouraged us all to read Sartre and coached us in debating, and we used to do, you know, these national debating competitions. So, you know,
so great for opening up the mind and introducing you to a variety of things.
Yes.
And what about art? Were you interested in art? Was that part of your life?
Yeah, well, you know, we were interested in art and sort of furniture and, you know, paintings and all of that. There were paintings in the house, but, you know, they weren't sort of wildly contemporary, you know, up to the minute paintings. But I think my mother was quite interested in arts and crafts, and we all got that from her, and I went on a little bit further.
And with the auctioneering end of things, were there a lot of sales of
there's some
antiques or
yes,
art
yeah,
or things
that's
like
right.
that?
Well, you see, I think that was the if you like, the hobby of a lot of people, you know, people like my mother. So there were a lot of sales after the 1930s and indeed after the war. And my father being an auctioneer, and Carlo being quite, if you like, in the pale, there were a lot of big houses, people moving out of them, going back to England, and a lot of furniture sales. And indeed, yes, my mother became very interested in antiques and would go to all of these sales. And she did have a very good eye, but she hated going to my father's auctions because when he saw her bidding, he would wait and wait and wait because he didn't want to be seen to be a favouritism, you know, and she'd go off her. Goodness sake,
that's
would he ever? Yeah, would he ever? Yeah.
Bid.
So, so she did, and we were all sort of brought up with these, I suppose, this furniture.
You went on to study art. You obviously had developed more than just a passing interest. And when you went on to study history of art, what was your mother's reaction to that?
Well, I think she was slightly concerned, of course, because of, you know, how you manage yourself or how you, you know, earn money or, you know, earn your living later on. But she didn't stop it at all. And I think she thought that after that degree, I might go on and do something professional.
Something useful.
Yes, something, you know, in inverted commas, like law or something, because there are two solicitors in the family. And so I think she kind of liked it in one way. She certainly didn't stop me doing it. But then she was sort of anxious, when you finish that, what are you going to do then?
Running the Hugh Lane Gallery, inevitably you're meeting with big business and people who run large companies with budgets that can support the arts and so forth. Are you dealing with big egos with those big businesses? Do you have to convince them, pander to them?
Well, I think that egos, there's egos in the art world as well. So, you know, accustomed to egos. So I find usually that with sponsors, the sponsors that maybe I've been fortunate about, you know, they set down what they would like from it. A good project is what a sponsor likes to see, you know.
But I suppose a good project to one person, it's beauty in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah,
a good
yeah.
project for you or yeah, for someone yeah. might not be what a senior banker or somebody thinks is a good project. I mean, you brought the Francis Bacon studio to the Hugh Lane Gallery, the entire studio with contents, and I'm sure many listeners have seen it. Anyone who hasn't should go and see it. But was that a difficult sell to the corporate world?
Well, that was a very difficult sell. It was amazing. The corporate world didn't quite understand that. City Council supported, but the corporates didn't get it.
It was a bit of a slow burn.
Yeah. Well, you see, the visualization is difficult when we're working with visual all the time. But I still was in the middle of relocating it and recreating it, so I couldn't show it to them except in picture form
or
photograph form.
Part of the beauty of the whole thing is that it is a complete mess, isn't it? It's got all of these disorganized elements of paper and drawings and draft and everything. And everything is laid out as it was in his studio.
Oh, Richard, I wish you could have walked into that studio. When I was brought into that studio by John Edwards and Brian Clark, it was an assailing of the senses. There was a riot of colour. The mess was like glorious mess. I think that children absolutely adore, but it was a glorious mess. And the smell of turpentine and paint. And there was an attitude in there. I'm not saying the spirit was lingering, but certainly it had taken on a sense of self. And in that small space, some of the greatest figurative paintings at the end of the 20th century were created.
It's interesting when you look at Hugh Lane himself and his own life, which and his love of Dublin City, and he had this sort of strange relationship that he loved Dublin, but he was so frustrated with the powers that be and the environment. Just tell me a little bit about that and his relationship with the city, which resulted in the museum, in the gallery.
It's actually his birthday today, the 9th of November. He was born in 1875. Yes, we go back to a time when people went from Ireland to England, you know, as they do now, but we had one government. So there was a lot of movement around. Hugh Lane made his business as an art dealer in England, primarily in London. But his philanthropic work was in Dublin. He was the nephew of Lady Gregory, and she inspired him, you know, with that wonderful zeal and zeitgeist that was going on of the creativity and the Celtic revival. And so he started and set about setting up a gallery of modern art for Ireland, which, amazingly, he did. And every single painting from the original collection of 300 works was given to the city. However, he was wanted a building, and this is where he kind of came a cropper.
He wanted to build it over the Liffey.
Well, he wanted a few places. First of all, he thought Stephen's Green. They couldn't find a site, and you know, now I'm sitting here in the 21st session. For God's sake, lads, could you get a grip? There's a load of land. Like, just move out a little bit, and you would get it. They couldn't get the site. They thought of Stephen's Green. Lord Ivy didn't want that. They thought of around Earlsford Terrace. That didn't work for them. Then Marion Square, that didn't work. And then Lutyens, his friend Edwin Lutyens, the great architect who has designed many things on Lambay Island, came over, and then he thought, well, we'll build it across the Liffey. Now, he thought this was a great idea. Now, and it very narrowly lost it the vote. And he was very upset and very annoyed. He was in his 30s, don't forget. So, you know, he wasn't sort of a wise old man saying, I'll wait now and we'll discuss this. So in a fit of pique then, he took out 39 paintings from that collection of his, including his Great Impressionists, and said he was going to send them to London. Kept saying he was going to send them to London, kept saying he was going to send, and eventually he did in September 1913, the same time as Yeats wrote his fiercely polemic poem, September 1913. He brought them to London thinking, because he was a gambling man, he was an art dealer, thinking that once he showed them in the National Gallery London, Dublin go, oh my God, we'll build it anywhere.
We need them back.
And of course, London didn't really treat him that well either. They promised him an exhibition of the entire works, and then they kind of rode back on that and then said, well, you know, we'll only show these, we'll put that Renoir in the basement because it's not really worth showing, all of this upset him. So before he became director of the National Gallery of Ireland in 1914, and before he left to go to New York in 1915, he wrote a codicil to the will. When he got annoyed, just sorry to jump around, in 1913, he also wrote a will. He loved writing wills, and he was only in his 30s.
It was a way of venting when you're annoyed
venting.
About something.
And of course, his sister, Ruth's child, said, now get that, you know, get that will witnessed. Oh, God. So he wrote a codicil to it, and he said he'd leave them back to Dublin, and the paintings that were in Belfast as well. But he didn't have it witnessed. And the trustees of the National Gallery London refused to honour his wishes. More recently, the agreements have been much more collegial and allowing greater access to all of those paintings for Dublin audiences in the gallery.
You basically get access, or you get to have them in Dublin for a set number of days per year.
Although we have them for a length of time, 5 to 6 years, with a lot of them here permanently, and then others rotate. And so we're just about to finish a new agreement, which I think will be even more positive than the last agreement.
When you look at the challenges of your job, and we've talked about how you're effectively running a business as well as needing to know a lot about the art world, when you look back at your mother's stepping into the situation there after your father's death and she took on the business, did you learn a lot from her, do you think?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, I learned her. I think her, she was very brave. Of course, you know, I mean, I'm sure at times absolutely terrified. She wasn't afraid to take a calculated risk, which I think is, you know, when you weigh up the pros and cons. And she also had an unerring instinct to seek out very, very good advice, and didn't go to 10 people, you know, like a headless chicken. Well, you said this. And I think that looking back as you get older, you know, at the time, your mother, you know, it's like, oh,
was she a
mad
tough taskmaster?
she wasn't really, but you know, I mean, yes, I'm sure, you know, how you behave, how you act, all of that, but not hugely, but there were six of us, so can you imagine?
Was she good at giving you praise, or would she say when she thought you'd done well?
Yeah, you know, she would, but she wouldn't be as much as parents today who keep telling our children we love them. I mean, why are we doing this, you know? I mean, the praise was when you got it was very nice. She was very supportive, I have to say, Richard. Now, she could get into a temper and didn't like what you were at, and you're teenagers and you're wild, and, you know, and then in your 20s, and where were you? I was trying to ring you. You know, I'm in Dublin and I can't say, well, I, you know, didn't come home last night or something, you know.
No, like, mobile phones.
No mobile phones in those days. So I think a pretty normal, but exacting in a way, liked good behaviour, liked you to, you know, didn't, she was, that was good fun. I have to mention that. She was good fun.
And if you're dealing with businesses and fairly hard-nosed financial companies and organisations, and you want to try and do some kind of a deal with them. How do you approach it? I mean, is it a mixture of charm And a bit of browbeating, or do you need to be steely, or what do you need to do?
There has to be a bit of steeliness, because, you know, I mean, there's no point in me talking for 2 hours to somebody who says, oh, that was very interesting. And so you kind of like to know a little bit beforehand that we have some interest in it. And I think a bit of passion also. Bit of pushiness and charm. And sometimes it doesn't work at all, which is what you always have to try.
Absolutely. Barbara Dawson, director of the Hugh Lane Gallery, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you, Richard.